Welcome back. Coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y-R-E-T-T. That's Eddie Floyd, knock on wood, in case you're keeping score at home. A team of researchers with members from several institutions in France has conducted a study regarding sleep talking, and has found that most sleep talking is not only negative in nature, but involves a large amount of swearing. In their paper published in the journal Sleep, the group described, where were they going to publish it? Field and Stream? The group describes their study, which involved watching and recording hundreds of volunteers as they slept. In analyzing the data from 230 volunteers who agreed to spend two nights sleeping in the lab, the researchers found that sleep talking, volunteers said the word no four times as often as when they were awake. And they also found that the F word was spoken much more commonly than while awake, on average 800 times as often. And this news bulletin just in, still no cure for cancer. Startling accurate predictions, televised seances that were banned in Britain, attempted communication with the late Diana Spencer, and a 5,000-year-old oracle from India that revealed the story of his life with 100% accuracy. My conversation with psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker is next on Coast to Coast AM. Craig Hamilton Parker's career as a psychic medium has been closely associated with his family and wife Jane. Soon after they met, Craig gave up his career as chief executive for an advertising agency, and Jane her job as a psychiatric nurse to pursue a career as mediums. To earn a living, they gave private readings, and Craig wrote psychic news columns and a number of books for the U.S. publisher Sterling. Craig Hamilton Parker has also written extensively about dream interpretation. His book, The Hidden Meaning of Dreams, became a bestseller, and he has hosted the U.S. TV show Nightmares Decoded. Craig and his wife now spend their time spreading their messages of mystical awareness and survival of death. Craig Hamilton Parker, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
First of all, I want to commend you. You and I have talked about this before, but you have one of the great website domains, psychics.co.uk. How did you manage to grab hold of getting a one-word domain is extremely difficult. Psychics.co.uk.
Yeah, well, psychics.co.uk was available at the time because I was very early onto the internet. I could have chosen quite a few domains, actually, a lot of single names there. If only I'd known at that time the extent that the internet would take in our lives, you know. So, yeah, I was very lucky to get that. And, of course, it stayed with me. And I built on there now. I put all my articles on there, and we have a community on there, chat rooms and so forth. So it's and forums. So it's a great place where people can come together, and it's been, you know, important to me, and was my first way of reaching out to the world, really, through other than just in the UK.
Right. Well, you got in on the ground floor with the website psychics.co.uk. That's got to be worth a fortune. I want to talk about your TV show, Psychic Family. I've read sort of the, you know, blurbs about it, and they said the family that's so psychic, even the dog is psychic. Well, I always thought all dogs were psychic, but I mean, do you have a dog, and is it psychic? Is he or she psychic?
Well, the dog's gone to the spirit world now. We've got cats at the moment, but certainly our dog William. He was my nemesis in many ways. He was here before I met Jane, and he used to growl when I came into the room. But he had a real it's a funny thing, you know, when psychic people come together, because Jane and myself are both mediums, we call ourselves here in the UK, able to communicate with the spirit world, so which is a psychic type gift. And it kind of rubs off, I think, on each other. I mean, it rubs off on the children. It rubs off on the animals around us. William, the dog, used to sit at, when my wife Jane was doing a reading, for example, and someone was in distress, he kind of knew straight away if there was a real problem. And sometimes, and the cats do it now too, would sit outside the door outside when the consultation's going on, you know, and sort of kind of treat the person with almost a form of compassion. I'm sure animals are very, and children, are very sensitive to many things that as adults we lose.
Oh, 100%. Just a quick story on that note. My mother-in-law was visiting my brother-in-law and his lovely bride over the Christmas break. They have a little poodle named Louie, adorable. But my mother-in-law has had some pain, and she's one of those people that she never complains, and she has this pain. It was on her right leg, and the dog knew immediately. He went over and put his head down on her sort of on her right thigh in her lap, and was licking her right leg. They know. Do they
They know,
smell
don't they?
that, or what?
And also, my understanding with the way it works with survival after death with animals is that animals retain their sense of identity after death, as we do as humans, and they become spirits too. And I think the contact with human love in earthly life gives them a sense of I-ness, a sense of personal existence, which they wouldn't get as wild animals. And in many ways, I think the fact that animals interconnect with us in human life in this world actually makes them continue as a soul in the next life. It's like we rub off on them. That sense of I that we have as humans begins to emerge in the animal kingdom.
I want to talk about some of your predictions, and I mentioned this to you before, and that is one of the things that you do that I have to commend you on is when you get something wrong, you call yourself out on it. You don't try and bury it or avoid it or just kind of skip over it. You say, you know what? That one, I blew it. I didn't get that one, but you know, and then you'll list something else that you did get, but you do mention the ones that you get wrong. And I find that very commendable, and it gives you more credibility.
Well, we have to do that. It's otherwise, what's the point? You know, because when it's like sometimes we're fallible as psychics, and just as we are as people. You know, we get some things right, we get some things wrong. But when you look at the bigger picture and you look at it as the overall view of it, you can see that people that have a genuine gift get a far higher percentage right than they would by chance. But they do get. They do get insights sometimes that are so out of the ordinary that it's more than just a hit. It's something, well, how could you possibly have known that? You know, and that's so we have to call ourselves out if we're getting something wrong, and we do sometimes. All of us psychic people do. Nostradamus must have got stuff wrong too, you know. But if we get certain things that stand out like real beacons, then that should make us think something about, you know, is the future, is it possible to see the future?
Well, two of the sterling examples that you called, we have to talk about. One is Brexit. How soon did you call the Brexit vote? Because everybody, all the major news outlets, right up until even after the polls closed, were saying it was going to be a no to Brexit by, you know, as many as 10 points in some cases. But you went out on a limb and said no. It's going to be a yes for Brexit. How soon did you know?
Well, really, right the way through, right from the start, my immediate feeling was that Brexit was going to happen, even though everybody took it for granted that it wouldn't. I mean, here in the UK, it was almost as if the Prime Minister at the time, he just didn't care about even putting an effort into it. It seemed like it was a done thing. Everybody assumed nobody would possibly vote for us to get out of Europe. And I had a very strong feeling from a long time before, because in my predictions, I think right back in 2004, I was saying that eventually Britain's going to leave Europe. And when it did come around, I felt right the way through. And even though people were saying, because I published my predictions on my website, and you can comment on there, and people are saying, oh, no, ha, 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 you know, can you really feel Brexit's going to happen after all this? You know, you don't stand a chance for it to happen. And I felt really strong that it would, and it was a shock. Everybody here and around the world flabbergasted that Brexit happened. And I think when you do psychic predictions, you know, you've got to give what you see. You can't just go be an influence because opinion polls have changed or so forth. You have to go with what your gut feeling is, and I stuck with it, and that's, yes, it happened, you know.
And the other was the election of President Trump. How soon did you call that?
Well, I called it just before he stood. So I was kind of shocked that what I'd seen had happened. And when I felt Trump, when I again, I felt Trump would be president, right from the very beginning and stuck with that despite what people are saying. I mean, everybody says, ah, oh, they're Trump, no, he doesn't stand a chance, you know. So right from the start, I felt, yes, this man is going to be there. It's funny, you get a feeling about things. I often get, you know, dreams. I get senses through my connection with these Indian oracles, which we'll talk about later, I think, have kind of heightened my understanding that the future can be predicted. I never thought it could. You know, it used to always go against the grain with me to think that the future could be predicted, because it kind of knocks free will out of the equation when we do that. But no, I saw Trump, and I feel, you know, and I've made a lot of predictions about Donald Trump over the time. And he was there. No, despite what people said, I thought he was going to be president, and he was, of course.
And you called that even before he announced his candidacy?
Yes, I was saying something. The actual details were saying, I was saying something about a TV personality is going to be is going to stand for president. And then when I saw it was Trump, that's it. That's what I'm seeing.
Right. And for the skeptics out there, I mean, you document these, and some of them you post on YouTube. Are the Brexit and the Trump predictions part of your 2015 predictions on YouTube?
Not sure if there's a YouTube one for that, but they're certainly all over the website. And I obviously date it so people can see the datings of things on there. But yes, on the YouTube, there's 2015, 16, and 17 out there, I think.
I want to get into, after-death communication with you. But one of the things I thought was incredibly courageous of you to do was to take on noted atheist Richard Dawkins in a debate. How did that go? And this was televised. How did that go?
It was. And actually, you know, I know everybody calls him Darwin's Rockefeller and so forth. It's one of the most skeptical men about this type of thing there is. But I actually, firstly, I liked the man a great deal, because my thought is, you know, this man is not, he's not doing this, he's doing this because he genuinely believes in this objective world as the only reality. And yeah, we had a very good debate. They filmed, first of all, me giving a demonstration of mediumship at a spiritualist church in England. And I was a little bit upset with the fact they didn't show the full thing, because people were, for example, I come to one woman there and I said to her, you got the tar mills. What's this about tar mills and Doncaster or something like that, I said to her. Well, apparently the tar mills is what they used to call the sweet factory down the road. And when they interviewed her, they paid no attention to that whatsoever. And all those little things that really clinch it to prove that how on earth could you know something so specific, which about something about the complete other end of the country, which was just a local thing for that woman. There was lots of things like that. But then the actual debate itself, I felt was pretty good, because I actually agree with Dawkins on a lot of things. I believe that we can't, well, that word believe, I think belief is sometimes a bit dangerous. We must trust experience, and we must trust empirical facts as well. But so I'm with him on the fact that, you know, just because, you know, we believe there's a chocolate teapot going around the earth doesn't mean it exists. But then I disagree with him fundamentally about many of the ways that science tries to address our reason for being here. You know, the whole concept of consciousness we got into and argued about, the whole idea of the continuation of the soul, the existence of telepathy, and also about, you know, evolution itself, because, you know, he talks so much about Darwin, but we forget that William Crookes and others, and that Darwin was not the first person to come up with the idea of evolution. It was, in fact, a spiritualist that came up with the idea of evolution.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, then the spiritualist discussed it with Darwin, and then Darwin then thought, I must publish it. I must publish that. Oh, I've forgotten his name. Famous person. What a nuisance.
It'll come to you. It'll come to you. So Darwin was sort of like the Edison of his time. He took other people's ideas.
Well, it's funny. A lot of great ideas kind of emerge simultaneously in the world. And although Darwin had already started writing his ideas about evolution, it was... But, oh, I've forgotten the name of the person. What annoying. It was when they But it was only when he met the spiritualist that it triggered that I must publish.
Interesting. I'll tell you a little hint when I forget something. If I squint my eyes and I look up into the right top-hand corner of the room, it usually comes to me for some reason. I don't know why. Craig Hamilton Parker is with us. Did you score any points? I mean, did with Dawkins, or did, let me put it this way, did he concede any points that you made?
Well, I think with him, you can only ever get a stalemate. I don't think you can ever win or lose, because he's looking at the whole idea of spirituality from a different sense. He believes it's all belief systems. I believe that the fact is that, you know, the objective world is not the only reality. That we have a whole different reality, an inner reality, a world of consciousness. And I say that consciousness can survive physical death, that the human apparatus does not generate consciousness, but is built more like a television that transmits consciousness into this world. So, you know, two completely different standpoints.
What would be your, we're heading into a break here, we've got about 3.5 minutes. What would be your best piece of evidence for life after death communication, either just to the general public or to Dawkins?
Well, I don't think you can say, you can't put your finger on one particular thing and say that is the final answer. Although some great experiments were done, such as the cross correspondence that people could look up on the internet and things like that, where groups of people around the world brought information together separately. But you have to take the information as a whole. It's more like putting a case in a court of law. It's not just the one specific fact that makes it work. It's by bringing all the evidence together, the evidence about what comes through people like me and mediums, but also through things such as near-death experiences, people's experiences in meeting the dead in dreams, children's experiences, things like this. That there's also, when you add all the evidence together that we have accumulated for life after death, then we find that there is, you know, when the evidence is taken as a whole, there is such empirical proof that it's definitely the case. It's proven through all the facts together.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about this seance that you were involved with that was televised to communicate with Lady Di, Princess Diana. But first of all, why was that banned in Britain?
Well, it was very sensitive at the time because it was the royal family, I don't think, liked the idea. So unfortunately, the objective of what we wanted to do was to give proof that Diana survived. That's all we wanted to do. As spiritualists, we felt we were asked to do this, and we thought, well, this would be something that could, you know, Diana believed in life after death, and, you know, we felt she could communicate. So there are strict rules in the UK about transmitting anything to do with mediumship. It's very controlled from the earlier days by strong Christian groups that don't like mediumship. It's become much easier nowadays, but at the time, I think a lot of those laws kicked in. In America, there was also, it was a bit too contentious, I think, for the mainstream programs. And in the end, it had to go on pay-per-view. But it certainly caused a stir worldwide. And yes, it was quite a story.
Yeah, it was seen like by something like, it was over 30 million viewers, wasn't it?
Yeah, and more. I mean, goodness knows how many have seen it since. Because, I mean, it's been streamed again recently, I believe, in America. And I think, you know, with this type of thing, it's such a contentious subject because people saw Diana as almost a goddess. You know, she represented to people something that seemed to be every woman's plight, you know.
Certainly, certainly she was. Listen, Craig, we'll take a time out. We'll come back. We'll talk about the seance, and then we'll get into this remarkable mystical journey to India and the Oracle. You'll tell us all about that. Craig Hamilton Parker on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back. And if you like what you're hearing tonight, this morning, I invite you to check out my weekly syndicated radio show, The Conspiracy Show, airs Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM. And for more information and a list of affiliates, you can go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. And I also want to tell you about my brand new podcast. It just launched early December. It's called Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can check it out and subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Or just go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio. It's everywhere. All right, when we come back, more of my conversation with Craig Hamilton Parker as we discuss his seance to communicate with Princess Diana on the other side and the remarkable story of the Knotty Leaf Oracle right here on Coast to Coast AM. Psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker is with us. He's joining us live from Great Britain. You were asked by American television producers to conduct this live seance to make contact with the spirit of the late Diana Spencer, Lady Di. But they tried to set you up a little bit, didn't they?
Did, yes. Just before I go on, that was Alfred Russel Wallace. That was the person that invented evolution before Darwin, from the last little section. But now, yes, it was kind of set up a little bit because there were people, for example, sat around the seance table when we actually did the final connections with Diana, who didn't even know Diana, and that was on Jane's readings, and she actually picked up on that person and knew, said, "No, you didn't even know Diana," which kind of threw them a bit, because now when you communicate with somebody like Princess Diana, of course, there's so many reasons people could argue that it's not a communication, because there's so much in the press, there's so much you could look up. So we had to have people around the table that we, first of all, didn't know anything about and couldn't tell research or know anything about them whatsoever. And those people also had to actually know Diana really well. These were friends and confidants of Diana's. So they could tell us, they knew personal information with Diana that nobody else would know about.
And who chose the participants, Craig? Was it you or the producers?
Well, we had nothing to do with the choice. We didn't know who was going to be at our table until we actually sat down minutes before. So we were blindfolded. We were kept in another area of the building, and then we were kept separated. So Jane and I couldn't communicate with each other. Jane did the first set of readings. I did the second set of readings, and then so nothing was done beforehand, so that we had no idea who it was going to be.
And so again, they planted some people to try and, I guess, discredit you, that knew nothing about Diana. They didn't know her. And Jane, in particular, your wife was able to suss them out immediately.
Yes, indeed she did. In fact, this was all overseen by someone that came from the university who was an arch skeptic, to make sure that, you know, there could be no cheating from the producer's side either. And, first thing she did is picked up, she had a number of people around her table. First thing she said is, "You didn't even know Diana. I don't know what you're sat here for," you know, which completely threw away their agenda of trying to trick her.
I guess it would.
And then at the same time, of course, then we both gave connections to Diana to each of the people around the table. And in Jane's sessions, for example, she knew that one of the women there worked with AIDS and had AIDS, and was able to tell her things about all the work she'd done with Diana's charity, and lots and lots and lots of little details that really blew the minds of these people that were sat there, things that nobody else knew. And the same for myself. I mean, I gave my consultations to the people around the table, and again, it's nerve-wracking, I tell you, because, you know, you're being told to do something because you don't know. At all, if you're going to get anything until you sit down. That's the way mediumship works. You kind of don't even know if you're tuned in until you open your mouth, I find. That's how it works with me.
Right. And people are watching you, waiting for you to fail. It's almost like watching figure skating, where people are waiting for the person, you know, to fall.
Yeah, even the people filming it in some respects, you know. I mean, because, you know, and my attitude is, if I can't get anything, well, I'm not going to make it up. I'll just have to say, sorry, I look an idiot. I'll be an idiot to the world. I'm not connected, you know. So, and I warned them at this, you know, that, you know, this is how the way we have to work. You know, we're not going to do anything that's not true. And also, anything we did for this too, I have to add, we did this purely because we wanted to do it to help the spiritual cause, as it were. All, we didn't take any money for this, and all funds were given to a Diana Trust. So Jane were doing it purely to prove life after death.
And how quickly or how long did it take for the spirit of Diana to come to you?
Well, she was with us before, in a way, because we went around Paris, first of all, and we're picking up on information in Paris. But you're picking more up on the places and the feelings of the places. It was only when you sat down and started giving the readings for the people sat with us on the table that the information started to really flow. I think, for me, the strongest point came when, you know, even the people sat there, and then you hit something that is really important. And I think the one that really changed people's thinking was when I said to the lady who, Louise, I think her name was, who had been Diana's secretary for some years, I said to her, you used to keep in your pocket special sweets for Princess Diana, because she was always, you know, she was bulimic and always on a diet, but you used to carry these sweets with you, and these were specifically called pear drops. Now, I don't know if you have those in America as well.
I'm not familiar.
But they're a specific form of sweets that they have here in the UK. And she was blown away because she said, God, how did you know I kept pear drops? I used to always keep a packet of pear drops in the pocket. And when Diana used to come up to me, she said, have you got a pear drop? You know? And it was little things like this, you know? And it was that, and I used to one of the other men, I said there, he'd been in charge of something. I said, in Windsor Castle with Diana, you and Diana used to go and fry eggs in the small rooms because she always fancied an egg sandwich, right? And there was things like that that, you know, now there's no way that you could look that sort of stuff up.
No, these are not people in the public eye.
Morality that appealed to anybody. Sorry?
Right. I said these are not people that were in the public eye. She didn't publish a tell-all book.
No, there were none of these people I'd ever seen before. I mean, there were things like there was a correspondent there that must have been in the public eye, but I'd never heard of him before. I didn't know Diana's personal secretary, of course. She's not a face that you would have seen on the...
Right. So, and when you revealed that information, she must have let out a gasp.
Fell off her chair, and I think everybody did there too, because, you know, even, you know, these, we're not dealing here with people that are spiritualists or open-minded to it really completely, because they're coming from journalistic backgrounds, they're coming from charity backgrounds. There was people there from a musician and things like this, and you know, they weren't people like perhaps like listening to this show that would be open and thinking about these things all the time. These were people that were a little bit armoured.
Sure.
It's quite a battle, I tell you, in some ways. So you have to give what we mediums call evidence of survival. You have to give these evidential facts that nobody else could know.
So you mentioned the fried egg sandwiches and the pear drops. Was there maybe one more specific example that you could give? Do you recall?
Let's think. Well, I mentioned the name of the lullaby that one of them had written there for Diana. I mentioned things such as the stories of Windsor Castle and about how she tripped on the stair and things like this. There was lots of small things that, taken together, add up to give really good proof of life after death. And that was our objective. You see, mediums, they don't, we're not really a telephone line to the spirit world. We pick things up through our unconscious mind. It's more like picking up things from a dream, where you get feelings, you get thoughts, you get images, you get impressions, you get flashes of events that happened. And that it's not like some Diana saying, hey, Craig, our name's so-and-so, and this, like this, 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 this. Sometimes we get, this is what we call a clairaudience. But often it's little bits and pieces that come together that make up, that in themselves seem insignificant, but together, taken as a whole, become quite good, strong, evidential proof that life continues.
So when you receive messages from Princess Diana, you're saying it's all on sort of the unconscious or subconscious level. In other words, you don't hear her voice, you don't see an apparition.
Well, you get the feel of that. You hear the voice, you sense the person, you get a feeling of their personality. It's a blending of thoughts that That's how mediumship works. It's
right.
It's like a form of telepathy in a way, except it's not a telepathy with someone that sat in front of you. It's telepathy with someone in the spirit world. Their thoughts overlay the medium's thoughts. And my job is to push out what appear to be my thoughts and focus what appear to be thoughts coming in from outside of myself.
So obviously, the million-dollar question, the $64 million question everyone wanted answered was Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, were they murdered? And
yeah.
What did you find out?
Well, this was the difficult one because she was absolutely adamant. Once we made the connection, once we knew that we had Diana, once we had a lot of proof and the people around the table all accepted that it was Diana communicating, then I could ask Diana the question, were you murdered? You know? And the answer came back a resounding no. Now, that is not what people want to hear, because people that are interested in all this thing, to be honest, want to hear all sorts of conspiracies, want to hear all the things about, you know, was she killed in the ambulance, was she pregnant, was all the rest of all those hundreds and hundreds of questions that come up, you know, what was that flashing light in the tunnel and everything. And her answer to me was, no, it was an accident. We were being chased and the car went off the road, it was as simple as that, and we hit the column, you know. And, you know, and I thought, God, I don't want to say that, but that's what I had to say.
Right. The producers were not interested in hearing that, probably.
No. And program makers, of course, want to get a headline. But that was the feeling we had. It was an unfortunate accident. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there weren't other things going on around Diana. Now, I did another reading some years before. That's kind of how this came up, because I gave a reading to a woman that was one of her, she used to do the colonic irrigation for Diana, and Diana used to go to her all the time, and I gave a message from Diana to her in a unexpectedly in a reading, and I didn't know it was Diana at the time. I said, she gave you a Romanov, something owned by the Romanovs, a little thing, and she actually brought a photograph of the object that Diana had given her. And in that, she said to me afterwards, Diana was absolutely terrified that she was going to be murdered. She said to me,
yes,
you know, horrified, because the Secret Service were following her every step of the way. But even in that, I didn't feel that early connection with Diana, that a murder had taken place.
Right, she had written letters to Scotland Yard.
Diana at that time. Sorry?
I said she had, in fact, written letters to Scotland Yard expressing that fear.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Mm. She was obviously horrified and terrified by what was going on around her. But I think maybe they were going to do something like that. But certainly the day it happened under the Alma Bridge, that was a pure accident when that happened. I'm sure a lot of the royal family must have sighed a great sigh of relief initially when they saw Diana out of the picture, you know. And
right,
I'm
right.
sure there were people in the Secret Service who were glad to see her go. But that wasn't them that did it is the feeling I got from that, which is unfortunate, because I know as soon as I say this, everybody goes up in arms. Oh, but what about this fact? What about that fact? What about that fact? I have to give what I got from that seance. And although I know it goes against the grain with most people, that was what happened as far as I understand it from the messages we were given from Princess Diana.
Remarkable. The pear candies, to me, that little detail is just is very impressive. I want to talk about the Nadi Leaf Oracle. Now, you see, this was an education for me, Craig, because I always thought, when I think of an oracle, you know, the Oracle of Delphi, I think of a person. I didn't know that an oracle could be an object. So what is this Nadi Leaf Oracle?
Okay, well, an oracle tells the future, basically. So, yes, an oracle can be a person like Delphi, or it can be also like a book like the I Ching that a lot of people may use, or the tarot cards. They can be an oracle. But the Nadi Oracle is something that absolutely blew me away in a way that I've never encountered before. I mean, I've been looking for this oracle for many years. Now, as you know, at the top of the program, you talked about how I got on the internet very early. And in the days when it was pretty much email and a little bit else, I got in touch with some friends in India. We were talking and I was saying, can you ever find the Nadi Oracle? And I heard about it, you see. Now, this oracle, allegedly, at the time, it's supposed to be able to tell you everything about your life 100% accurate. And I'd kind of found a few old books about it from the past, of people that had consulted it, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, these things are just beyond belief. You know, the oracle is supposed to be 100% what it said. So I started trying to track it down. This is, like I said, just at the early days of the internet. And I made a friend called Vivek, and we were talking about it a lot. We were both very interested at the time in the Indian holy man called Sai Baba. So we were communicating about a lot of things that were happening at the time about that. Now, then some years later, well, a lot of years later, 2 years ago, I think it might have been now, we connected again through Facebook. And he said, Craig, I found the Nadi Oracle. And I said, oh, what? And he said, well, the Nadi Oracle's everywhere in India, actually, Craig. There's Nadis everywhere. But to find the real one is very difficult, because it's like with all of this stuff, you know, you get the real stuff and you get a lot of imposters. And I must warn people, if they want to go out and start hunting for it on the internet, be enormously careful, because most of it out there is absolute trash. But he found...
It's like the knockoff Rolexes in Times Square.
Even worse, because you know, you might change your life by it.
Right. But it's why is it called a leaf oracle, Craig? What is it? What does it look like? What is it made out of?
This oracle was written 5,000 years ago by seers that saw the future of any person that will consult it, and it's written on palm leaves. These are sort of like wooden sort of slats, a bit like a Venetian blind, where they're tied together by a piece of string through the middle. That's how they used to write the books years ago in India. And it's written in an old form of Tamil. Now, Tamil's the language of southern India, but this is an older form of Tamil that you still find on the temples. It was originally translated from Sanskrit into Old Tamil and then into Tamil and then retranslated into English for me. And so that's why they're the palm leaves, because they're written on the old palm leaves. Now, when you consult it in two stages. The first stage is to find out your leaf. Now, that sounds... That sounds strange to use the leaves to find a leaf, but there's a number of ways to do that. And some people measure the shadow, but the southern Indian system is to actually take your thumbprint. So I set up a reading to do this on Skype, and all we sent was my thumbprint. Now, this was going to be done over Skype, so I set up a fake Skype account, I set up fake email addresses, I gave fake names, and I wouldn't connect with the guy until the absolute last minute, when we arranged the time for the connection to be made. Now, with just my thumbprint and no other knowledge, it was sent through proxy emails, and there was absolutely no way he could have tracked me down or checked me out on the internet. Yeah, that's important. And I have to say, this was going on before the times of the internet as well. Those earlier stories I'd heard about this. Now, what you do...
Let me just interject here, Craig, because we're coming up on a break, but let me just clarify here. So the person on the other end of Skype, they had in their possession a legitimate Nadi leaf oracle.
Yes. They can get... They have the oracle, and this thumbprint will find them my leaf, as it were, my chapter.
All right. We'll find out about your leaf, your chapter in the Nadi Leaf Oracle. We'll take a time out. David Bowie, Life on Mars, one of the greats, taking us into the break. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM.